good evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Just a big shout out today to all the authors of Betrayed, the anthology published by the Authors on the Air Press. We are live on all ebook platforms, so please stop by and give us a look. Today, it is my absolute honor and pleasure to have with me one of the most esteemed playwrights in culture today, in American culture and in the UK. You may know his work because he wrote a little play called Agnes of God that was later turned into a film with Meg Tilly. It was an absolutely spectacular piece of work. Since then, he's written many successful plays, television movies, miniseries. He is a highly awarded three-time Emmy and Golden Globe nominated playwright and screenwriter. He has received the Humanist Award, the Writers Guild Award nomination, Gemini nominations, an Edgar, a Cammy, and a Christopher Award. He is also married to Irina Garden, who is a lovely, lovely poet. He is visiting me now from the theater in London, where he is creating a play on The Exorcist. It is my pleasure to welcome John Leonard Pielmeyer to the show. John,
welcome
so much. I'm so happy
thank
you're
you.
Here.
I'm so happy to be here.
I am thrilled for you that you've had all these accolades, and now you've added novelist to the wonderful resume that you have. John's new book is called Hook's Tale. John, will you tell listeners about this book, please?
Well, Hook's Tale is Captain Hook's memoir. We all know Captain Hook from Peter Pan, and this is Captain Hook's memoir in which he tells the true story about Peter, behind his life story, which sets the record straight on Peter Pan.
You have a very interesting comment in the description of this book. You say, J.M. Barrie was a dour Scotsman. And I love that line. He just got it all wrong. And Captain Hook is really, James Hook is really a good guy who's it just went awry somehow, correct?
Right, right. Now, personally, I am extremely fond of J.M. Barrie. He's one of my writer heroes. But James Hook wasn't that fond of what Barrie did with him. And so this is the true story of Captain Hook.
And Captain Hook's real name was Captain James Cook, for those
That's
of
correct.
You who don't know that. How
yeah,
much
Barrie
research
himself
did you
says,
do?
He, quoting, Hook was not his real name.
So, John, how much research did you do in writing this book? But before you answer that, tell me, what got you interested in Captain Hook?
Well, I mean, I have a long history with Peter Pan. It was the first book that was ever read to me by my mother. My mother read it to me. And the book she read, of course, was not the J.M. Barrie Peter Pan. It was the Walt Disney Peter Pan based on his
sure.
animation. So it was a little golden
sure.
book or whatever that was called back then.
Yep.
That my mother read to me night after night after night. And my mother would tell me a story that when I was like 4 years old, she said, what do you want me to read to you tonight? And I said, oh, read Peter Pan again. She said, I'm so tired, I can't do it. And so I said, okay, I'll read it to you. And so I picked up the book and I started reading it to her. And she was just blown away that this four-year-old had learned to read. But of course, I'd simply memorized the book.
Memorized.
And knew exactly when to turn the page. So it was kind of inbred in me from the very beginning. But when I was I used to be an actor. And when I was at a theater in my younger acting days, I saw a production of a J.M. Barrie play called What Every Woman Knows, which is a beautiful
yes.
play, and it was a gorgeous production. And I was so enthralled by this. I only knew Peter Pan at that point. So I went to the local library and found a copy of the collected works of J.M. Barrie, meaning his plays, and I just took it out and read everything I could on him. And at the same time, an incredible biography called J.M. Barrie and the Lost Boys by Andrew Birkin came out. And so I plunged into the life of Barrie and his writing, and I just fell in love with the man, so much so that I wrote a one-person show with the cooperation of the Barrie Estate on Jay and Barry. So, which is a long way of saying that my research on this book that I wrote was done years and years ago. I've lived with this man pretty much all of my life.
And so it sounds like you had it in you. You this was a story waiting to be written by you.
Well, thank you. I mean, I will tell the story about how the idea for this book came to me.
Please.
My wife and I were on a cruise in the seas. We were cruising from Chile to Tahiti about 3 years ago. And, you know, the cruise went to Easter Island and Bora Bora and all these fantastic places that I'd always wanted to go to. But the very first stop on the cruise was an island called Robinson Crusoe Island, which I knew nothing about. But it was the island on which Alexander Selkirk had been marooned. Now, Alexander Selkirk was a British seaman, sort of knew this ahead of him. He was a pirate, essentially, who was on a ship in the South Seas in like 1704. And he was on a ship that was leaking. And he went to the captain and said, Captain, I think this ship's going to fall apart if we don't pull into port and fix this. And the captain said, no, I don't have time to do that. And if you're not happy, get off the boat. So they marooned Selkirk kind of voluntarily on this uninhabited island off the coast of Chile. And then they sailed away and the ship did sink. And the sailor, everybody drowned or was imprisoned by in a Spanish prison. They were picked up by a Spanish ship, and England was at war with Spain at that time. So they were in prison for a long time. In the meantime, Selkirk spent 4 years on this island alone, making his clothes out of animal skins and hunting and surviving. And every day he'd go up to a mountain ridge and light a bonfire, hoping to be rescued. And after 4 years, he was rescued, brought back to England, and he became, and this is absolutely true, the very first celebrity survivor. People were astonished and overwhelmed by his. He was like a 15 minutes worth of fame. And one of the people who read his story, because it was printed in all the newspapers, was Daniel Defoe, who said, man, this would be a fantastic book. So he based Robinson Crusoe on Alexander Selkirk. Consequently, this island is now called Robinson Crusoe Island. And it is
fascinating.
It's a beautiful little island. It's part of an archipelago. And there's a tiny town on it. But all you can do on this island really is hike. And there are gorgeous hikes on this island. So the ship dropped us off, and my wife and I started hiking on the island up to the ridge where Selkirk would light his bonfires every day. And about halfway up, we stopped to catch our breath. It's a very steep climb. And I looked out and I saw our cruise ship anchored in the bay. And suddenly it occurred to me in, like, I swear to you, 4 or 5 seconds, I thought, man, this is where Selkirk was marooned and inspired Daniel Defoe for Robinson Crusoe. And Robinson Crusoe in turn inspired Robert Louis Stevenson to draw the map for Treasure Island, and that in turn inspired J.M. Barrie to write Peter Pan. And suddenly I thought, my gosh, I'm walking on the inspiration for Neverland. And suddenly the
what a fabulous story.
It wasn't the cruise ship anymore. It was Captain Hook's ship was out in the bay. And we climbed to the top of the mountain ridge and looked over, and there was Mermaid's Lagoon. And up on the north was a promontory that was Tiger Lily's village. And I thought, I'm walking on Neverland. It was so real to me. And I got so excited.
Wow.
And suddenly I started asking myself, well, wait a minute. This island itself is an archipelago. Was Neverland and part of an archipelago? Where did Captain Hook sail when he wasn't here? Who did he pirate if he was a pirate? How did he get here? How come he doesn't fly? I mean, all of these questions started pouring into my brain, so that when we got home from this cruise, I literally walked into my office and sat down and started writing this book.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my
gosh. It was like I was possessed.
I did not know that string of connections. What a fascinating thread that is.
Yeah.
Alone.
And I knew all of this because of my love of J.M. Barrie and also Robert Louis Stevenson, whose works I just adore.
Wow. And so today we have Hook's Tale, which is a perfect, perfect name. And the book jacket is gorgeous. And
oh,
you are getting
beautiful
accolades all over the place. Yes, it's fabulous. I'm enjoying it so much. It just is a terrific book. I'm going to put it on our page for our book reviews. I just love it so much. And Yes, it's magnificent. I hope this means that you will consider writing another book one time. Yes? Maybe the book bug has gotten you?
I have two other novels that I have finished, but that I'm in close to completing. Let's put it that way.
And, John, then you're going to have to come back and tell me about
it. Actually, for a sequel to Hook's Tale. So
you're going to have to come back. That's all there is to it. This is this is like the continuing story of John and Hook. So I would love to have you come back. How delightful! Thanks. You know, it occurs to me though that here you are so wonderfully successful with this debut novel, but you've had such an amazing life. You mentioned that you, you know, your mom read to you a bit, and I'm assuming that your love of reading created your exceptional imagination.
Well, thank you. I love reading. And my mother was also told me stories, and I was told I had a neighbor friend and an aunt who were just great storytellers. So I grew up with people, with women, telling me stories.
How lovely. Now, you, where did you grow up, John? What part of the country did you?
Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Okay. So I hear storytelling, you typically think of the South because it's very generational and, you know,
stories,
you move your history.
Everywhere.
Right. So, and thank you, Mom, and all these wonderful women who spurred your imagination there. But was it your intention to become an actor?
Yes. I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid. I decided when I was around 12 that this is what I wanted to do. And I desperately, just achingly wanted to do this. And I wrote plays when I was a child. I'd never seen a play, but I wrote, you know, these plays that I would perform in my living room with my sister as an actress with me, and then a neighbor girl across the street who sort of took my sister's place because I enjoyed kissing her more than I enjoyed kissing my sister. And
you're so funny.
And thank God. And so I wrote these plays, and I also wrote some short stories, but I never thought I could be a writer. I just thought, well, I didn't even consider it because it was beyond imagination that people could do this or that I would be able to do this for make a living doing it.
It's so interesting to me to hear you talk like this. You remember when we emailed, I mentioned to you my very best friend that we grew up next to each other.
Yeah.
She always knew she would be an actress, and we teased her mercilessly about that. We thought, what do you mean you're going to be an actress? Are you going to be like a Marilyn Monroe or something like that?
Yeah.
She just would hold her head up, but she also would be the one who would put on the neighborhood plays, and we'd go in my garage, you know, and charge the neighbors a nickel to get in, and my mom would make the Kool-Aid and so on for the intermission. So I remember all that quite well. And she, true to form, has become quite a good stage actress and has
Fantastic.
Done some film. But she is also a playwright. And I mentioned to you that she teaches Spolin workshops all across the South.
Yes.
And when I mentioned that you were coming on, she said, oh, I'm telling all my students. So I hope, Jean Marie, if you're listening, you'll call in. And speaking of calling in, if you'd like to say hello to John, we're going to talk more about his plays and his wonderful television movies and miniseries. Please feel free to call in and say hello. The number is 347-633-9609. The most recent memory for me of your work is The Memory Keeper's Daughter, an exceptional book. But you turned that into something very, very special. Will you Thanks. Talk about working on that particular piece?
Sure. Well, you know, the offer came to me and I read the book. I was just so happy to be able to do it. It's such a wonderful, you know, it's a great story, and it was a wonderful piece that I could see for three very talented actors. And we had an extraordinary director do it. And I was just really thrilled with how that turned out, what happened with that. Boy, I don't know. It came pretty quickly and pretty easily for me. I, as I recall, I, I wasn't on set. I usually am when I can be, but that was a situation where I was absent on another project, and so I couldn't be on that set. But it was, it's a lovely piece and a beautifully moving story.
It is a fabulous story. I agree with you. Now, you also did a very successful screen adaptation of one of my favorite writers, Ken Follett. You did The Pillars of the Earth. Will you talk about that, please?
Oh, I can talk about Pillars of the Earth forever. I mean, it is, of all of my projects, it's probably the one that is closest to my heart. I had such a good time on that project, and it turned out so well. There were wonderful producers involved and a brilliant director and such an incredible cast. In fact, I'm still in touch with many members of the cast. It's just wonderful. I just happened to see one of the actors in it in a show in the West End the other night. David Oakes is doing Venus and Fur in the West End in London, where I am now. And it was just a project that I was so happy and lucky to be involved in. It was terrific.
Tell me about
that. Say to anyone, if you could see one thing that I wrote, go see that. Look at that.
Well, let's talk about the cast.
So
and tell me, tell listeners, please, who is in the cast and why it works so well. Was it serendipity? The moon aligned with Mars.
Yeah,
John,
was,
is that
exactly.
What happened?
It was just a great set to be on. I mean, the cast was extraordinary. Eddie Redmayne was in it. Haley Atwell, Ian McShane, Donald Sutherland, David Oakes.
God.
Liam Garrigan. Sam Claflin. It was Sam Claflin's first piece of film. He was hired right out of acting school. In fact, he had to leave the set, as I recall, to go back for his graduation. It was extraordinary, and it was just a lovely experience.
How wonderful! How long are you typically on the set when you're doing a screen adaptation?
Well, it kind of varies from piece to piece. I mean, I love to be on set if I can, and Pillars was a great example of that. I mean, that shot for 6 months, and I was there in Budapest and in Vienna for most of that time. And what I love about the theater and film is that it's a very collaborative process. And that can be what's fun about it, if you have collaborative people involved, and everybody is excited about that. I remember one time doing Pillars of the Earth. I don't know, we were 3 to 4 months into shooting, and they were about to shoot one scene that involved the character that Eddie Redmayne played and the character that Haley Atwell played. The characters were married at that time, and the scene involved a picnic that they were having. And the director said, you know, there needs to be something more going on here than what you wrote. I mean, essentially, so I sort of rewrote the scene and turned it into a kind of scene about a moment of marital conflict that they were having. This was turning into a more of a real, not quite the happy ending marriage that we were hoping for, or the audience was hoping for. And it turned out to be a lovely scene. I kind of wrote it on the spur of the moment, but at the suggestion of Sergio Mimici Gazan, who was the incredible director. And we got along, Sergio and I just kind of got along so well that he would say something and I'd spark on it and go off and write something.
When you are on set, when you're filming, whether it's television or for film, do you ever have the urge to direct?
No. I'm one of those writers who has no desire to direct. I don't know how directors do it. I don't want to do it. I mean, it's that simple. And because of that, I'm probably not very good at it. I've directed a couple of productions of plays of mine, usually initial productions, and that was okay. But I don't feel it's my calling, and so I don't do it.
Well,
it's
there you go.
Other,
it's a whole other group
of muscles you're exercising with direction.
Wow. Most of the folks that are blessed me with a visit to Authors on the Air are writers. Book writers, And of course, we're in the high point of award season right now. We just the McCavities and Anthonys just finished up this past week. I'm so excited for those people I know who won awards. But you also won an Edgar Award, which is highly coveted in the book world. Would you tell about what you won the Edgar for and how you felt when you received that?
Well, I wrote a play called Voices in the Dark that was done regionally and then on Broadway, and I won that. That was when they had the category in the Edgars for best play. They don't have that category anymore, I'm very sorry to say. But I won for best play, and the ironic thing, of course, is that I was the only nominee. And the really funny thing is that, I mean, this is typical, I think, certainly of me, and I'm certainly of a lot, probably of a lot of authors. I went to the awards dinner still nervous that I might not win.
even though you're the only one in the category.
They might go up and say, okay, this in this play category, we had a nominee, but we've reconsidered. We don't think he's worth getting this award.
Oh, no.
I sincerely thought that, you know, there's a weird – so that's how paranoid I can be. And
you're so funny. I think that everybody who's nominated gets kind of gets that feeling. And I've been to enough award show when I see the stunned look on the winner's face. And they're kind of look dazed and confused. So
stunned look on the loser's faces too.
well, they smile, though. You know, everybody
smiles. They
smile.
Right.
With gritted teeth, maybe, but they smile. Tell me, what is a Christopher Award?
Christopher Award is an award given by someone will correct me on this. It's a Catholic. The Christophers were a brotherhood, Christopher Brothers, monastic brotherhood, although they're a teaching brotherhood, I believe. And they used to have a Sunday morning show years ago, I think called the Christopher, or they sponsored a show. I know the name of it, but it slips my mind now, years ago. And I don't know if they still give this award. They probably do, but I'm not sure. It was sort of an award that I got for Choices of the Heart, which was my very first television movie. It's what I also won the Humanitas for. And it was an award sort of, I think, acknowledging excellence in dealing with important moral issues, important social human issues. And this movie certainly did that. It was a movie
about
in 1980, some people who Americans who were around then will remember that in November of 1980, there were four American church women who were murdered in El Salvador. Their bodies were found.
Yes.
Three of them were nuns, and one was a lay person who had gone down to do work with the poor in El Salvador. And
I remember that.
These four women were shockingly murdered, and for a long time, we all knew who had done it, and we now know that it was the El Salvadoran government and their soldiers that were involved. But our government was denying that at the time in a shameful way. And so it was decided to do a movie about a young woman named Jean Donovan, who was the lay woman of the four of them who lost her life. And Choices of the Heart was about her journey, about her choice to follow this path in her life. She was far from being a, you know, what one would call a saint, but she was a tremendously inspiring, good, wonderful person. And so this movie was her story. It was starred Melissa Gilbert in her very first adult role. She was extraordinary in it, and a number of other people were just wonderful in it. And I was so lucky to be able to write it. It was kind of the launch of my television writing career. And
how wonderful.
Yeah.
John, now, I'm not sure how this works, but when, as a playwright, you choose your subject, you write the play, and then you send it out hoping that someone will pick it up and want to produce and direct it and so on.
Right.
Is it the same way for movies and television, or does someone come to you and they ask you to write the script?
For my career in television, it was almost always where someone would come to me and ask me to write something. There aren't that many television movies anymore. I was writing sort of in the heyday of TV movies. There aren't many people who do those anymore. There are more miniseries and limited series now. But I was lucky enough to be in a position where people would come to me and say, are you interested in doing this? And they'd present a project to me and I could say, yeah or no.
Do you think with the advent of streaming movies and video like Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, would you have an interest in doing episodic television streaming film? You would.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah. Because it's the wonderful thing about what episodic television has become is it really gives authors, writers, the opportunity, I think, to write novels.
Yes.
In a sense. I mean, these limited series or full series they're essentially long, wonderful, the best ones are long, wonderful novels.
Yes.
It's what Dickens was doing back in the 19th century in England, serializing his novels. Every week they put out 12,000 words.
Wow.
And everybody would wait breathlessly for the next episode of
12,000 words in a week.
Words.
Wow. That's amazing. So I know that it is considered the golden age of the small screen, that there are so many good things on these streaming services. I must confess that I don't own a television, so I don't watch them. But, you know, I'm not oblivious. I know what people have told me about. Another thing I have noticed that a lot of my guests have come from either film or television, and they seem to have a really good sense of how to write in the long form because they've learned to write a story in a short form. Do you find that to be the same thing?
Well, it's interesting. When I decided to try my hand at what I will call prose writing, novel writing, a number of years ago, I sat down and I said, okay, I'm just going to write a short story. And just for practice and see where that leads me. So I sat down and wrote a short story that by the time I was done with it turned into probably a 400, 500 page novel.
Well,
it's one that I have not released yet. I'm still kind of putting the final touches on it. But I started writing this story and it just unlocked a door for me. And I couldn't stop.
Wow.
In the
obviously.
I like
500 pages? It's like, you know.
Well, it was a long, it's a long,
50,000 words
book
or something.
Not, book is a short, is a fairly short novel. And my other novel is fairly short. But this is my very first novel that is probably going to be my third novel out is much longer.
Europus Magnus. Absolutely. How wonderful. I want to kind of skip back now to what you're doing. You, besides writing maybe a sequel to Hook, you have a couple other books that you're working on, which I'm thrilled to hear about because I won't be in the West End anytime soon. But you are there now because you are doing something so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And I think this is in conjunction with an anniversary of a film. So will you tell listeners what your project is now?
Well, I'm currently working on a stage adaptation of The Exorcist. It opens in the West End on the 31st of October. And I'm just left the sort of last rehearsal before we go into the theater to start a text. And it's extraordinary. Cast and production directed by Sean Mathias. And certainly what Sean and what I tried to do in writing it, what Sean is doing in directing it and what the cast is doing in acting it is to find the truth and reality behind all of that. you know, this is a deeply moving story. It's not a camp story. It's not really ultimately a horror story. It's or a negative horror story. It's a story that's very much about belief. And it's a story that essentially has a happy ending.
Really?
So that, yeah, I mean, if you really think about the story, it turns out that, the person that we worry about survives. And and lives are drastically changed by the end of this tale.
So, John, how did you create the play without duplicating the film?
Well,
you have a different take on the bones of the story, I'm assuming.
Well, probably not the bones, but some of the flesh. The play is based on William Peter Blatty's book. He also wrote the screenplay, which is an extraordinary screenplay, for which he won an Oscar. But I went to the book because that's actually where the rights were available, essentially, and adapted the book. And so the bones of the story are the same. Those of you who are familiar with the movie aren't going to be surprised in the, you know, overall telling of the tale. It's pretty much the same. But there were some details in the book that I just wanted to expand upon, that I thought were really – that lent themselves to the stage and to expanding and talking more about these people and these characters. It's as much a character piece as it is a sort of horror story or a melodrama, however you want to describe that. And there are little bits and pieces, little hints that Bill Blatty gave in the book that I leapt upon and galloped with a bit. And Bill Blatty, God rest his soul, was so generous and so kind to me. He was an extraordinary man and is an extraordinary writer.
It seems to me that, as I told you when we were in the green room, I read voraciously. I love books. I'm oftentimes disappointed when I see a film that is made from a book, that's adapted from a book, simply because I think that so much of the undercurrent or the undertone of a book is lost when it translates to film. And I understand that because there are many moving parts in a book that a reader can see that you can't really see on screen. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that you picked up some of those things and have turned those into a little bit different kind of play. Yes, the storyline is there, but maybe motivations or reactions or emotions.
The motivations are the same in a way, but I sort of expanded on them and sort of helped put building blocks under them in ways that I just found very interesting. I mean, one of the challenges of writing this for the stage is, of course, I'm limited to a certain amount of actors. We have 8 actors on our play, and that's... And we have to tell the story on a stage. We can't just
You don't have a lot that you're working
quite
on.
Quite the way that a movie does. But of course, in some ways, it's even more generous. I mean, this is a play, but it's a book that I felt at the same time lent itself to a stage play. It essentially took place entirely in a house, mostly in a bedroom.
Yes,
and it's such an intense piece. It's the kind of piece that I love to see in the theater. I love pieces that will just, take me as an audience to the edge. That's where I want to go when I go to the theater. The movies don't often do that, but I think theater has an opportunity. If you see an incredible piece of theater, it is like nothing you ever experienced.
Oh, I agree. To me, there's nothing like connecting with the actor right there. You are in the moment, and it's such a different experience. For folks who do not go to live theater, regardless of what it is, whether it's avant-garde, whether it's Broadway. Oh, what a gorgeous thing it is.
I love actors, and it's so amazing. I mean, I put my actors through the paces in this piece. I mean, it is a very demanding piece emotionally for these actors to do. And it's so, at the same time, so exciting to see these actors come up to bat and do it. It is like watching, on some level, a sports event, something live.
Yes.
That is really happening before your eyes. These actors are going through this experience in a very personal way, right before your eyes, and taking you along with them.
I think that, you know, as a lay person looking at what you're talking about, I think what you're saying from my point of view would be, when you're creating a film, you're doing 5 minutes of a scene and then stopping, and it's behind a camera, it may be out of order, scenes are out of order, versus when you're live on stage, there may be dialogue that it goes way beyond five minutes.
Well, and it's not that
there's no break.
It's not that the scenes are that long. Most of my scenes in this play are fairly short, but it is doing them essentially all at once in order, every night, knowing the path that you have to walk. It's walking. It's like going through an obstacle course for an actor, I suppose one might say. You know, you have to get over this fence and under this bush and around this tree, and you got to leap over this. These burning coals, and hopefully you'll make it to the end every time.
John, has it been your experience that someone has talked to you about a book and said, you know, we'd like you to write the play, and you found that it just doesn't translate well?
Yeah. I tend to forget about those things that I say no to. Because for rightly or wrongly, I say no to them, and they're certainly just not right for me, is why I feel I say no to them. And then I just move on to. So I can't give you any example of something I've turned down.
Oh, that's okay. I don't want one. No, I don't want one. Do you think that you would like to turn Hook's Tale into a theater piece?
Oh, boy. I think, right now. I'm thinking more in terms of turning into a film or a television limited series. In my brain, that's probably where my brain is going to take it next. It could certainly possibly be a theater piece. It's really big and broad. And at the same time, my brain writing it was in the novel mode. So now I have to sort of shift it into another mode and kind of translate it into another language. And I'm so close to the novel language of it right now that I need to slowly do this transition into thinking of it in another form. It'll happen.
Do you enjoy having the extra words that you get when you write a novel?
Well, I had a great time doing this. I never thought I would. I never thought I could write descriptions or enjoy writing all those in-between things, between dialogue. And I had a good time with this. And it was very freeing, because what I found about novel writing for me was that I was on my own. When I write for movies or television, and ultimately even when I write for theater, because they're collaborative processes, I'm always kind of writing for other people. When I write for television and film, I have to send it to the producers to get their notes, and then actors give me their notes, and so forth and so on. And this was all me. I was the only one giving myself notes. And that was very freeing. I loved that.
How lovely. Do you think that Exorcist will come to the States? Or is this a limited production? Oh, it will come to the States. Oh,
yes, I do believe that. I can't go into any specifics about that.
Yeah, I don't want to. That's fine. If you think it will, I think that's marvelous.
And I'd say in about a year.
I hope that it's someplace where I am, so that I can go and say, I spoke to him when. Tell me a little bit about you personally. What do you like to do in your spare time, John?
Read.
You
and I like to read.
You really?
And I like to hike. I like to hike on islands, and I like to read.
What do you particularly like to read?
Oh, I read everything. I usually have two books going at the same time, at least one fiction and one nonfiction. I'm personally very fond of reading when I can. I love 19th century literature, usually preferably British literature. You know, I just love Dickens and Eliot, and I've just started to get into Trollope. I love Robert Louis Stevenson and so forth. But that's, you know, that's kind of one kind of escapism. But I love to read. I love to read mysteries. I read lots of contemporary books when I can. It's just, you know, I always have something going.
Whose book is on your nightstand right now? Whose book is on your nightstand?
I'm just finishing a biography of Charles Dickens, and I'm about to read. I'm in the middle of Charles Dickens's Child's History of England, which I'd never read. So that's kind of what I'm reading now. I have some mystery books piled up, but I'm so focused on the play right now that I'm not getting in anywhere near the kind of reading I usually get in when I'm not.
When you're reading something whether it's fiction or nonfiction, do you have to be cautious that it doesn't overtake what you're writing, that you don't weave any of somebody else's story, or are you?
No, I'm not
so
really aware
mind?
Of doing that. No.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of writers mention to me they don't read while they're doing their own work.
Oh.
They don't want ideas and everything else.
Oh,
it's
that's
just, you know, it's
no, I just
different
love
for
to
everyone.
Be inspired. But other books could just inspire me, I hope, if I respond to them, if they're good books. That's, I read them for inspiration.
What would you tell someone who wants to be a playwright for theater? What advice would you give?
Boy, I'd say, practice. Just write and do what you can to hear your work. You know, get actors together to hear your plays being read. If you can get productions of things being done, write short pieces, do them, find ways to get them done. Because you can really, I believe, only learn this craft by doing it. And it's a craft. It's as much a craft as, you know, making shoes, building bookcases,
cooking
carpentry.
Meals.
Yes. Cooking. It's a craft.
I agree with you.
And you have, there's stuff that you bring with it, but there's also a certain amount of nuts and bolts you have to know. You have to know about. You have to learn how to do. You better be good about grammar. You better be good about even though you may be breaking grammatical rules, you better know what those rules are before you break them.
Sure, that makes sense. John, I want to ask you something. What would we be surprised to learn about you?
Oh, what would they, boy? Oh, boy, I don't know. I still want to be an actor. I still act occasionally. I'm in Pillars of the Earth. You can see me in the Pillars of the Earth.
Lovely.
I don't know that I'm that. You should ask my wife that question, not me.
I shall. Now, and let me just preface my next statement by saying we discussed this in the green room, and Irina Garden is a fabulous poet, and among other things. And I have asked that she come on the show, and so you better believe, my friend, that I am going to be asking her what
Fantastic.
We would be surprised to learn about you. Okay, I'm going to ask her, and I'm going to send you the answer in case you're not around to hear it. John Leonard Pielmeyer, I have just enjoyed myself immensely. You're an absolute delight. I wish you all the success.
I've had a good time too.
And please come back. Come back and tell me about
anytime.
The other books. I want to hear more about it. And best of luck with the West End. And you're going to be there for a while, yes, do you think?
Yeah, I'll be here till the first week of November. Then I'll be home.
And then you head back to New York or to
yeah,
you live in upstate, correct? Yes.
Yeah, I
do. So, well, you know, have a delightful time. much success and break a leg. John Kilmeyer, thank you for being my
guest
today.
Everybody, read Hook's Tale. I'm so proud of it, and I'm just
absolutely
thrilled.
Hook's Tale is available now. We're in it every place where you buy books, so you've got to go and read it. Thank you so much, John. You and I will be talking again soon, I'm sure. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's my first show for today. I'll be back later on at 7 p.m. Eastern. Thank you so much for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Bye.